Our Midrash, my dear friends, records what is possibly the most protracted debate in all of history. According to its tradition, scholars from the school of a teacher by the name of Shammai, and scholars from the rival school of a teacher named Hillel, met and debated, discussed, puzzled for 2.5 years a single proposition, resolved that it were better had man not been created. We might phrase it, is life really worth the living? Is it really a joyous blessing? Or is it not rather a heavy and oppressive burden? Now this extended debate seems at first glance passing strange. Surely it could have been resolved in a much briefer time. But is it really that? You and I, every man, have definite opinions on any number of subjects. But when it comes to our overall assessment of life, our fundamental judgment on being, our point of view shifts with our mood, with our age, with our condition or our situation. When we are young, we thirst for life. We bound out of bed every morning. The lure of adventure is in our hearts. Our eyes are ablaze with the joy of life. Aging, it becomes somewhat more difficult to bestir ourselves with each dawn. Our years are at best bittersweet. They have their measure of disappointment, of defeat, of death. And we look ahead. We are somewhat frightened. The confident man says, life is my oyster. The bone-weary, broken man says, oysters give me indigestion. In the Bible, a magnificent document of human feeling and human hope and human vision records all of these various shifting attitudes of ours towards this life of ours. Ashreinu matov chelkenu, exalts the psalmist. How happy we are. How joyous our lot. Tov adonoi lakol, v'rachamav al kol ma'asav. The Lord is good to all, and the tenderest of his mercies are over all his works. The sun shines. The air is clear. The dawn is bright. Life is worth the living. But read on in the Psalms, you find other moods, bitter moods, harsh moods, despairing moods. Ki sava nafshi braot, for my heart is overflowing, sated with evil things. Hayai lishol yigau, my strength has been exhausted, drained away from me. Nechshavti im yordei vor, I am considered as if I am alive, if I am dead, though I am still alive. Ayiti kegever, ein eyal. I have become as a man for whom there is no help, no hope, no opportunity. And David will exult. I will sing unto the Lord with a whole heart. And Job will lament. Wherefore is life given to those in misery, and light unto the bitter in heart who long for death, but it cometh not? How would you answer the question this morning, at this stage and in this condition of your life? Has life been worth the living? Has it fulfilled your fondest expectations? Has each dawn been a bright dawning? Or has life been a rather thankless routine, hard work, And have you been buffeted about by its storms and bruised in the buffeting? Now, I cannot, of course, read your mind or sense your mood. But I would suggest to you that most men have answered in the negative, that it would have been better had man not been created. What proof have I? Simply this, that all of the great ancient religions and most of the great ancient philosophies are woven out of the stuff of despair, sewed together out of the fabric of fear and of loneliness. Life, they said, is a via dolorosa, a way of sighs, a road of tears. There is no release this side of the grave. In the East, men longed for nirvana, the absence of life, the absence of feeling, parole from the cruel sentence of having to be born again. And in the West, the philosophers agreed with the teachers of the East. Aristotle said it, not to have been born is best of all, and death is better than life. Now, of course, ancient man knew moments of happiness, the joy of accomplishment, the heady triumph, love. But surprisingly little of the joy of life is reflected in his serious literature, in his philosophy, in his books. Why so? Because his life was a bitter one. He was surrounded with difficulty. Job said it for him. Man that is born of woman is few of days and full of trouble. Man that is born of woman is few of days and full of trouble. Life was a wretched thing. One in two children died in their infancy. A mother could count on the fact that if she had three children, she would die in childbirth. One in two who reached the age of adulthood died before 30. And if he did not die before 30, he faced a life of being crippled and wasted. 95 in 100 men were other men's slaves, serfs. Few men could call their soul their own, and even those who could lived in cities which were plagued by disease, where war was endemic, where there was no security and little safety. Hope not, the philosopher Heraclitus wrote, hope not lest the unhoped for come, for which there is no trail and no path to it. Man that is born of woman is few of days, full of troubles. Life for the ancient was a rather wretched affair. But we live in the 20th century, in an advanced age, in what we confidently call a brave new world. What about our age? We are happy in our age, we tell ourselves. We will wage successful war on poverty. We have removed the blindness of illiteracy from half the world. We have circumscribed and constricted disease until it no longer plagues the world. So much has been accomplished. We have assuaged the physical torture which beset ancient man. Yet I submit to you that most of us are deeply suspicious of life, and that there are very few here who have lived any number of years who cannot testify that life can give you quite a drubbing. How can I prove my point? I might cite to you the applauded literature and philosophy of our day, which tends to begin with a single proposition. All life is absurd. We are born without our willing it. Life is a burden which we must carry as best we can on a long and distant way and to a destination which may not even exist. Modern life, Kafka once wrote, is full of possibilities. But every possibility reminds us of the inescapable impossibility of our own existence. But let me rather cite you philosophy or literature, which after all is but the more orderly creation of what exists within our own mind. Let me talk of us, of our instinctive response to life. And as proof, cite to you the amazing response to a book. Truman Capote has written a book about a senseless, brutal murder. He called it In Cold Blood. In the 5 weeks since its publication, this rather well-written report of pathological murder has outsold the initial sale of any volume in this century. Now, there is nothing classical about this book. It's a well-contrived and well-told story and nothing more. What accounts for this fantastic sale? Public relations, yes. The book was well-publicized, but the public relations expert can only harvest on a ground which has already been carefully seeded. I would submit to you that the sale of this book reflects something deep within our soul. We have lived through Auschwitz and Dachau. We have seen the photographs of corpses carelessly piled upon corpses in endless rows. We saw the slaughter of the Second World War. We have lived with the violence of Korea and the violence of Vietnam and violence in our streets. We live in a world where the missiles are smoking at ready on the pad, armed with their warheads. We live with violence. We live, if and when we admit it, with the realization that we stand on quicksand and that the world can suddenly open up at our feet and envelop us and suck us down. But all of these fears are too vague, too vast, too far away to be understood, drawn in, empathized with. It takes the story of the senseless murder of a Kansas farm family. A family not unlike our own, hard-working, decent, hopeful of the future, a good citizenship family, churched family, family which asked only to do its share and to be granted peace and an opportunity. It takes the tragedy of this family to reduce violence, the context of our life, into understandable terms. To admit, as we seldom admit, that life is a difficult way, that cruelty can suddenly and viciously intrude upon us, that all our securities, all our foundations are essentially weak, pliable, that there is no security this side of the grave. Our husband may leave the house happy in the morning. His voice lingers on in our mind. We may never hear his voice again. The child goes off happily to school, and a car careens suddenly on the sidewalk. We go to the doctor for our ordinary checkup, only to find ourselves under the sentence of approximate death. A rabbi stands in his pulpit to bless the congregation, and a dibuk seizes a tortured soul. We build, we plan, we labor, we sacrifice. And suddenly an economic convulsion draws down and reduces to rubble our best laid plans. And there is always that war room in this capital and in that capital with a little black box with a little red button and someone ready to press blow us all into Holocaust. We have reason to be deeply suspicious of life, even though with our science and our technology we have mitigated and assuaged most of the physical difficulties which beset ancient man. Indeed, as science conquered for us and made life for us bearable, our hopes soared high. And often the higher they soared, when they were frustrated and defeated, the more precipitate the fall, the more shattered we were after it. How can one live a sane and happy life, an often unsane and sometimes unhappy world. Some simply withdraw. They leave the cold winter, the hard workaday world for the sunshine climes, but they cannot leave the winters of discontent. Those who work with those who have retired from life because of age or simply because they no longer wish to be in the hurly-burly testify that these men and women are not only lonely, but frightened. Their personalities begin to disintegrate, for they have no adventure, no excitement, no purpose, no goal to look forward to, no work which gives them dignity. And some there be who simply withdraw into their rooms. The mother in this Kansas family, which was so brutally slaughtered, had long since withdrawn into her whitewashed, pristine bedroom. She lay there upon her bed in an unreal world. Was she the happier in that world? We cannot know. Psychiatrists who explore men and women who have withdrawn from life tell us of the terrors which beset them. Yet it was in this haven, in this security, on this bed of withdrawal, in which this mother was found, bound, gagged, murdered. The unreal world is no citadel, does not erect walls against the real world. It cannot protect us. Reality always intrudes. Whither shall I flee from thy presence? And some there be, when the shock waves of cruelty roll over our world, who simply buy stronger locks for their doors. This seems to have been the general reaction in Holcomb, Kansas, a little hamlet farming village in which the murder took place. There was a run on bolts and chains and locks. We love deeply and desperately, and we lose. We are hurt. Our hopes are disabused. How many there be who fear having lost and knowing the searing pain of loss, who fear to love again. They close themselves in. They lock up their hearts. And they walk a lonely way. And they walk, I submit, a maddening way. In the Union of South Africa, men have placed arsenals in their homes. They have built high walls, high fences around their yards. They have placed armed guards at their gates. And I submit that they are not one whit the safer. No man can make of his home, of his life, of his world an impregnable fortress. No lock will keep out the professional thief. No fallout shelter will avoid the war which we all fear. Violence can always kick down any door. How then can we live a sane and happy life in a sometimes insane and often unhappy world? I began by telling you of the ancient debate between the students of Hillel and the students of Shammai. I neglected to tell you the conclusion of that debate. The men met and they voted. They answered in this wise, philosophically, it were better had man not been created. But philosophy is not life. And now that man has been created, let him search his ways. When I first read this teaching some 20 years ago, I was put off by it. I felt it begged the question. Either life was worth the living or it wasn't worth the living. Make up your mind. Why tell me simply go out and be a good boy? 20 years of work with people, analyzing my own life, has convinced me that there is profound wisdom in this teaching. For if I understand it, it says this. There is no virtue in that form of jaundiced speculation, philosophizing, search, by which the self-pitying seek to unravel, to determine the context of life. For there are no answers to be gotten here. We can never make a final assessment that life is good, or that it is not good, that it is pleasing, or that it is difficult. Rather, grace comes to life in the graceful living. Happiness comes to life in the purposeful living. Decency comes to life in the decent living. Let man put off this form of commiseration, this endless speculation about life. Let him get about the business of living. So short the time for work or play, why grieve the night or waste the day? Ecclesiastes said it as well. The end of the matter, all having been said, fear the Lord and keep his commandments. But now that man has been created, let him search his ways. Now, I don't know how I would have answered in the first century the debate that was held between these scholars. Today, I would answer with the affirmative. But I believe that life is worth the living. For I often think of that first man, the primitive, crouching in his cave. How that first man must have rued the day on which he was born. Life was a daily, deathly struggle for survival. Against the elements, against predatory beasts, against an unyielding earth, against the other Homo sapiens who wanted to take the little that he had. There seemed no hope. He could not see research, skill, technology advanced, only that his children and his children's children would live as he had lived, fearfully, frightened, terrorized, crouching in the darkness. But somehow that first man had within him the capacities of hand, head, and heart sufficient to create civilization. And he and those who came after him, who put beside them aside the philosophizing, the worrying, the self-pity, and went on about living, doing, thinking, inventing, they built for us civilization. And they gave us the grace and the opportunity which we have in our lives. They made our lives better than their lives ever were. And what of our lives? Have we not, too, the talents of head and heart and hand sufficient to control the violence that walks in the back alleys and the dark nights of our cities? Have we not the skills to give better education, to provide better mental treatment, to classify those who may be pathological, to treat them, to give them guarded care? And have we not the knowledge sufficient to see how we can control war and establish peace in our world? We know what is required, the institutions that are needed. We have all the skills. If only we will leave off commiseration, self-pity, the throwing up of the hands in surrender, go about the business of living. But now that he has been created. Let him search his ways. Goethe said it. We men are always complaining that our happy hours are so few and our sad hours so many. And yet it is we who are to blame. If we opened our hearts to enjoy the good that God offers us every day, we should have strength enough to bear evil in its turn when it does come. Would it have been better if man had not been created? I believe not. I believe that God gave us the skills of hand and head and heart sufficient to the challenge and the task which he placed before us. I believe that there can be a sane and happy life in an often insane and often unhappy world. But I believe that sanity will come to us only in the living, only in the struggling to create things of use and beauty, only as we relate ourselves to the upward thrust of man, as we give our skills to our communities and to our civilization. And I believe that there can be happiness in our lives for all the violence which may be intrude, for all of its mortality, the happiness which comes of sharing, of sacrificing, of being sensitive to, of being kindly, The happiness which comes through and in the joy of others. The happiness which comes to us at the end of a day in which we can say, this day was not wasted. How brief the time to work or play. Why rue the night? Why waste the day?